Okay, let's see. Is that turned on?
Yeah.
All right. I can control it right here, Sam. I'll try to avoid having feedback there. So what we'll look at now is the next page of dealing with anger. Okay. And I wish I could say these are original drawings, but they're not. But remember we said that one of the ingredients or one of the components of depression and of faulty thinking is that of anger. And as you see here, anger is one of the main causes of breakdown of communication as well too. And yet anger is a very natural, reflective result of frustration, our reaction to having our goals blocked. Now, if you turn the page, we're going to come back to that. Let me see where that page is. See how many pages back it is. Well, it's really back there. There's another page here somewhere. Let me see where that's at. Well, I can't find it. But there's another page in here someplace where you'll see having to do with blocked goals. You'll come across it eventually, but you'll see that it explains about blocked goals. But suffice it to say, it's a very natural result of being frustrated or having our goals blocked. Like, for instance, when I'm watching a program on television and I know I got 5 minutes between the of a publicity, and I got enough time to get to the refrigerator and stock up for the next 20 minutes of programming, and my wife stands right at the top of the steps or right in front of the refrigerator and she wants to talk about something. What is my reaction? What's my natural reaction? I get frustrated because I know I only got 3 minutes left to get back to not miss anything of the program. So I love my wife dearly, but at that moment she is my enemy because she is frustrating me, she is thwarting me, and she is keeping me from attaining my goal. And we don't think it through this way, but that's the normal reaction. And so our anger is very natural, it's very reflexive. In fact, the Bible says that on at least 400 occasions in the Scripture, God gets angry. You have Romans 1:18, that the wrath of God is displayed, you know, against men who hold the truth captive, you know, and live in unrighteousness and so forth. And so we got to realize that anger is neither good or bad in itself, but it's an emotion that is created by God, and it can be expressed in a good or a bad way. Now, appropriate anger is anger that's against unrighteousness, anger that is justified. Inappropriate anger, James chapter 4, verses 1 to 3. You know, whence cometh the wars? Whence cometh all those things? He says, is it not the, you know, your passions that war within you? And so this egotistical or this self-centered anger where my wife is not giving me my way or something of that nature. That is a self-serving and a self-centered anger, and I really can't justify it. I can sure try, but I can't justify it. It's inappropriate anger. So we got to discern whether my anger is legitimate, appropriate, and justifiable, or is it inappropriate? And anger has to be controlled. Proverbs chapter 16 and verse 32 is a verse that has to do with that. And then anger has to be dealt with. Ephesians 4:26, don't let the sun go down. Otherwise, it becomes brooding and resentment. How we deal with our anger, what counts is what we do with it when it's present. And different ways, and again, the Proverbs are rich here. We suppress our anger, pretend that we're not angry. We express it. And when it says that death and life is in the power of the tongue. You know, we can really, it says irritation, the book of Ecclesiastes says irritation is in the in the heart of the fool. And so we can just let it rip, or we can repress our anger. And this is the worst possible response, because this is where our body has to deal with it. What we don't confess, what we don't acknowledge, then our body has to deal with it. And it is thought that many of the instances of cancer comes from our physical reaction to those things that we deny is going on in our lives. And there, I believe there's a basis for that. And I think it was Dr. McMillan in his book, None of These Diseases, he talks about some 40 illnesses and diseases that come have as a basis a repressed anger or internalized anger. And so there's a real basis for that. But what we want to learn is to be able to acknowledge our anger, confess it, like the psalmist in Psalm 32. You know, when I kept silent, it says, you know, he internalized this anger. He said his guilt, he said that, you know, it ate him up inside. But when he acknowledged it, you know, then he was on the road to dealing with it in recovery. So we have to learn to confess it in an acceptable way before it becomes problematic in our lives. Now, this is a very important graphic on the next page. Rules for handling anger. I want to acknowledge whether, you know, I'm angry at my wife. She's angry at me. I'm angry at my kids. My kids are angry at me. I'm angry at a brother or a sister in the assembly. We don't see eye to eye. We don't agree on whether we should do this or do that. And that's eating at me. So I got to acknowledge whether my anger is appropriate or inappropriate. Is it because she's not letting me have my way? Is it because this brother or sister is thwarting me from some goal that I might not even be aware of as being a goal? And then deal with the appropriate anger before bedtime. Hold no grudges. Leave vengeance to God. See false rights as really privileges. Going through these quickly because we still have a lot of material to look at. Confess inappropriate anger and receive forgiveness for it. And what I want to get to is to understand what our blind spots are. Now, what do we mean by blind spots? Well, as we see a little graphic here of an iceberg. Here's the iceberg that sank the Titanic, and I was the Titanic. You've got that 1/7 of the iceberg which is visible and above the waters. But the great mass of that iceberg is submerged, and you don't see it. It's hidden. And so it is of my motives, my attitudes, my feelings. You know, it says that all the ways of the man are pure in his own eyes, but God weighs the motives. God sees that big mass underneath the water that I'm not aware of. And you know what's a terrible thing is that my wife sees that too. And my kids see that too. And as brothers and sisters in Christ that we're close to, we see the attitudes, the motivations, and things that the other person can't see. And that's why we have to hear from, that's why it says the wounds of a friend prove his faithfulness. The kisses of an enemy are deceitful, but the wounds, the truth that comes from a friend, that proves his faithfulness. When I was first preaching up in Three Rivers, Trois-Rivières, in Capital Medellin, in northern Quebec, we were in a church of about, what, Marion, 180 people, something like that. And my French was atrocious. And yet I was preaching. And out of that group, nobody made a comment. Only one person, one couple, Jean-Louis et André, would come up after the meeting and says, Bill, you don't say it that way. Take a step, you say make a step in French. And he was the only one that was willing to correct my French. But you know, I loved them dearly because I knew they loved me. They loved me enough to confront, and whether or not they were going to hurt my feelings, that didn't matter. They had my welfare. They had my interest at heart. So I didn't sound like some foolish Englishman. They wanted me to learn the grammar properly. And I appreciated them so much. And so we need to hear the truth. You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. But as it says here, first it'll make you miserable, because we don't like to hear the truth too often, because we think we're doing so good, but yet we need to hear that. And that will prove the person's fidelity. We need to hear and accept the truth from others about those attitudes, motives, and feelings. The beautiful thing of using a tool like this is it's third person. It's not me confronting you. It's you and me looking at the inscriptured truth that's here in front of us. And so it's a side-by-side activity. When you go visiting somebody and you say, let's look at this together, or there's a teachable moment or something like that, you know, I'm not coming to confront them with this. I'm coming to share this with them as something that has given me some insight, and perhaps it can give them some insight, some understanding into their situation as well, too. And so it's a parallel approach to people helping, to visitation. It's not nose to nose, it's not eye to eye, it's not face to face, it's side by side. And it takes a lot of the sting out of the truth, a lot of the sting out of the reproach. And so it's not confrontational. We're looking at this together. What do you think about that? That's pretty heavy, you know? To say that there's attitudes, there's things. My kids are quick to point that out, you know. And, you know, if we deny the truth, you know, the truth is not in us. We deceive ourselves, it says in 1 John 1:9. And so we need to be able to be a model of accepting the truth, you know, for our children's sake, but for our brothers and sisters in Christ's sake, to learn to be transparent. Not the idea of letting it all hang out, but transparent enough that they can see that God is at work in our lives, and it gives them the courage to be able to take a closer look at their own reactions and attitudes and motivations, that sort of thing. Turn the page to the hot water heater. Now, here is a ministry that we can have one to another in the body of Christ. And this has to do, too, with visitation, but it has to do with living in the household of faith, as well as in the family. The idea of the old water heating system. Not a whole lot of us have this kind of a water heating system in our homes, but before we had radiators. And down in the basement, there was always this reserve tank. It was a tank there, where when the pressure grew, it was an overflow tank for that pressure. And then when the pressure decreased, the overflow went back into the system. So it was an overflow tank. Now, there are personality types. There are those who are dominant and hostile, and their attitude toward being frustrated or angered is to fight. And there are others who are more submissive and more tolerant, and their attitude is to withdraw from the conflict. And there is some biblical wisdom in that according to Proverbs. But what I want us to notice is the pressure cooker. And this is the pressure, again, that comes on us and comes on those people we're visiting from dealing with life. But there is a built-in escape valve when you're cooking with a pressure cooker, and you hear it. It goes like this. Anybody remember that? Some of you young people, it would have been your grandmother more that would have used the old pressure cooker. But works grill. Great. Now we have what's called the, what is it called? The thing that you put on. You put it on in the morning and it cooks all day. Crock pot. Now we got a crock pot. Before it was a pressure cooker. But what happens is, you know, your husband comes home, your children comes home, somebody comes home, or at church you hear, all of a sudden you hear this. What's happening? There's some pressure being given off, you know. You hear some frustration, you hear some anger, you hear the overflow of this pressure in somebody's life. Now, what we don't want to do, just like with this pressure cooker, what happens if we put our thumb on that little thing that's dancing on the top of the pressure cooker? What happens? Pressure builds up, and then what happens? There's a explodes. There's like a little cork there. You see it on the picture. There's like a little thing there, and that's really a safety thing. That's going to that thing that's dancing on the top is a safety device. And if we suppress that, it's going to pop its cork, we could say. And so when you hear somebody that has all of this pressure inside, and you hear this, that he said that and I said this, and then she did that and I did this, this rehearsal of this, of the pain and misery of the day or whatever it was, instead of suppressing that and said, I don't want to hear that, I've got problems of my own, let me tell you what my day was like, you know, or let me tell you what he said to me and what she did to me. When you hear that thing, instead of suppressing it, what you want to do is facilitate that. And like my wife used to say with her few French words, oui? No, c'est pas vrai. You know? And she was ministering in facilitating those people to tell her all that was on their heart and all that was on their mind. And they felt soulagés, they felt decompressed in it, in a sense, because she helped them get rid of that pressure. And that is a ministry. That is a real ministry of visitation. I remember not going with an agenda, but going to be available to somebody to simply hear what's going on in their lives. And maybe you're the only person that's willing to listen to what's going on in their lives. And maybe it's a broken record. Maybe it's the same story. I used to have breakfast every week with a brother who had been married 2.5 times. And for him, life was bitterness and gall. And we'd go out and I'd listen to his sad, sad story. And I could have told it just as well as he could, because I knew it so well. But that wasn't the point. The point was, I gave him the opportunity. And I used to get so frustrated with this brother, because he had a talent of just disturbing the waters, disturbing everything that was going on in the assembly. He'd come for a few weeks, for a month, and then he'd just stir waters, and then he'd leave, go back into hibernation in his apartment again. Then he'd come back in, and he'd stir the waters some more. And so I'd meet with him every week for breakfast. And then one day, and I was so angry with this guy. And then one day I saw the pain, and I looked in his eyes. And I could see the pain that he was living with. And so I realized, no, I had to stay with this fella. And still doing the same thing today. Nothing changed. And you know, this brings out a point I was talking about with a brother here, is that there are some problems that have no solutions. And there are some things that are never going to be resolved. And you have to put that in your mind, that some of these things that people are dealing with have no solutions. And some of the things that they live with are never going to be resolved. And so what can you do? You can be there to be a listener. And not the idea of agreeing with everything they say. You can explore and you can help them to, you know, other possibilities. But the truth of the matter is, they've got a lot on their plate. And perhaps they don't want to let go of it. And maybe an appropriate question is, aren't you getting tired of living that way? Aren't you getting tired of dealing with that month after month, year after year? Wouldn't you just like let go of that? Why do you need that in your life? You know, that's a confrontation, but it gives them perhaps the possibility of, because it's a decision, really. I used to go to the conferences with Tim LaHaye and what's his name, Larry Crabb, and Dr. Paul Meyer, Christian psychiatrist, Meyer Meredith Institute. And he wrote a book many years ago called Happiness is a Choice. Happiness is a choice, and this is a psychiatrist thing. It's not a pill, but it's a choice. And so you have to choose. And so they can continue to fight against what's going on, or they can learn to accept it. As Dr. Laura says, get over it. You know. So this is an important thing to say. Emotional chain reaction. We got to recognize this, too, that we bring stuff home with us. They bring stuff home with us. A hurt spirit leads to anger, leads to frustration. And so this deep hurt engenders hostility and conflict, but rather than dealing with it, with the cause of it, we carry it home with us and we dump it. And that can be dumped in the assembly as well. And so if you turn the page, you'll see an example of that that Norman Rockwell gives us. Here you see the employee getting read the riot act by his boss. The boss is chewing out the employee for something that he didn't do right. And of course you can't go back against your boss if you want to keep your job. That's not safe. It's not sane. And so what do? Well, you take that frustration, that anger, and you take it home. And then there's some little thing, like she didn't darn a sock, and that's just unacceptable. And so he dumps his anger on her now. And of course, what's she going to do? Well, then you see little Johnny there who's done some beautiful finger painting on the wall. And boy, you see her giving it to him royally, don't you? And then again, you see little Johnny passing on the gift to the cat or the dog, something like that. So this is this emotional chain reaction. And how you know that people are carrying a lot of baggage, we're going to get into this, is when something that's worth this much triggers a reaction that's big. Okay? Something that is very insignificant, and yet it triggers a big reaction to it. You know, they're carrying a lot of emotional baggage. And then that's a clue to need to be available to listen when you hear this, you know, to help to decompress that, alleviate that. Well, we won't go through this as healthy responses to an unhealthy dealing with conflict. Let's look at this just for a second. How do you approach conflict? How do they approach conflict? You see four approaches to conflict here: yield, resolve, ignore, and win. And the thing we want to see about this is that this is indicative of how important a person's relationship is with those with whom they are in conflict. You see the letters HV, LV, LPR, HPR. Those who will simply be submissive and yield when confronted with a conflict, or choose to ignore the conflict and says that there is no conflict. What do you mean I'm angry? What do you mean there's an argument? There's low personal risk. That LPR means low personal risk in avoiding a conflict, in avoiding a confrontation, in avoiding talking about something that's going on. Well, we'll just pretend it's not happening, or we'll just not say anything about it. Well, there's very low personal risk involved in that. But there, you see this HV and LP, well, let's just say resolve and win, there's a high personal risk involved in that, in risking bringing this up or daring to talk about it. And I mean, it can be something that we would say is insignificant. We have a Bible study every Tuesday morning. At first it was a lady that was all women, and then I was asked to teach that, and then some of the senior men came as well too, but the women dropped the prayer meeting. You know, and so one of the brothers then brought up the fact that, you know, before it was announced that this was at 10 o'clock, but the Bible study wasn't until 10:30, and there was a half hour that was there for the women to pray together. Why aren't the women praying together anymore? That was high personal risk. But what that high personal risk demonstrated was a high value that was put upon that by that person. So he took a high personal risk to bring it up, but it also demonstrated the high value that he placed upon that prayer time. And so there's things that go on in church, and sometimes somebody will disappear and you want to go visit them because they haven't been coming lately. Well, there's been an offense. There's been somebody that's had their nose bent out of shape, or they didn't like what was said to them or something like that. Well, there's some high personal risk involved in going to talk to them about it and bringing it up. but it places a high value on that relationship. To ignore or to win, that's placing a low value on the relationship. It says, I don't care about the outcome. The relationship is not as important to me as being right, as letting this winning, that sort of thing. So that's just the approach to relationships. Handling conflict, very quickly, don't avoid conflict by silence. Don't save up frustrations. A lot of times people carry a sack on their back and they just keep collecting the frustrations and the irritations and the annoyances. They all go into the sack. And then finally, when there's no more room in the sack, then comes the explosion, where one little thing can trigger this big reaction. And that's when they take the sack off their back and dump it all. And you're going to be the one that will facilitate that dumping. And you're going to be there to hear the whole thing, whether you want to or not. But that's great ministry. It's giving them a chance to, again, empty that sack, but then to be emotionally available to hear some other considerations that they've been blocked in thinking about. So prepare. Don't save up our frustrations. Prepare the setting for disagreement as well, too. Choosing a time, an appropriate time, to talk about important things. Learning to attack the problem rather than attacking each other. That's really important, too. And that's why I say a tool like this, or visual aids like this, and you can make these up from your own studies, from books you read. A lot of this came out of books that I've read, too. And what you do is you simply take that, the main outline in the book, the main elements of the book, and you put it down. You put it down on a sheet like this. And then as you share this with that person in a side-by-side relationship of, of a brother or a sister, the Lord brings to mind the elements and the principles of that teaching that you received from what you've read or what you've studied. And so some of the things I'm sharing with you came out of that as well, too. And from your own personal studies, you can develop those teaching aids like that with some visuals as well. Learn to attack the problem and not each other. Don't throw feelings like stones at your spouse. Stay on the subject. Offer solutions with criticism. Avoid gunpowder words, explosive words. Never, always, all, everyone. My wife had a way of getting me every time we get up Sunday morning. All she had to say was, I know we're going to be late. I mean, she could say that getting out of bed. And for the most part, she was right. She likes to be there 10 minutes ahead of time, just reading her Bible, meditative. And I feel great. We get in right on the minute. I'm here, But when she would not give me the benefit of the doubt, that was a button that, that produced an emotional explosion in me. I know we're going to be late today. For the most part, she was right. But I wanted the benefit of the doubt anyway. And so avoid the gunpowder expressions. And we know what buttons to push. We know what will set somebody off. And so wisdom tells us to be careful with those things. And then, as Ogden Nash said, when you're right, admit it. When you're wrong, shut up. Categories of solutions. One of the things you'll find when you're dealing with people that are locked in conflict is that things are very black and white. It's either his way or my way. It's either her way or no way. You understand? But there is a whole gam of possibilities in between that as well, too. And part of your ministry is to help people see other possibilities other than the black and white, other than it's all his way or it's all my way. And so here we see some conciliation. That's where one gives in to the other. Compromise, where each gives in a little bit. Coexistence, where each decides to stay on their own side and agree to disagree. But what we want to look for in helping people is creative alternative, and that is doing something that's different that is mutually satisfying. And in visitation, as in pastoral care, what we are doing, remember the Lord said in Matthew 5, blessed are the peacemakers. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they should be called the children of God. Those are the ones who are, God has given us a message as ambassadors that the world be reconciled to Him. And that those who are anchored in conflict and dispute within the family or within the marriage or within the home or within the church is to be a peacemaker and to be able to help them to be there as an umpire. You know, when it says in Colossians chapter 3, verse 15 to 17, umpire, as to have the final word. Let the word of God have the final word in every dispute, in every situation. I served on the board of a Christian school in Montreal, and sometimes they would get, this side of the table would get locked into a dispute with that side of the table over things of perhaps doubtful importance. And one day I took out a $2 bill. Canada, we have $2 bills. They were sort of a rust red color. But I put it on the table and I held it up this way and I said, now what do you see? Tell me what you see. Well, I see the Queen on this side. And what do you see on that side? Well, I see a bird, you know, flying over the ocean. Well, now wait a minute. How can you see the Queen and how can you see a bird? There's something wrong here. Well, there's nothing wrong there. Because from their perspective, they're seeing absolutely the truth. And from their perspective, they're seeing the truth too. And it's possible that both of those truths can coexist because they do coexist on a $2 bill or on a... It's saying that from their perspective, they're seeing the truth of the situation as far as they're concerned. And from their perspective, they're seeing the truth of the situation as far as they are concerned. And there has to be a meeting of minds that both of those things are true. And they can coexist as truth. And you have that principle in Philippians chapter 3, verse 15 and 16, where Paul says, if any be of the other mind, God will reveal that to them. And I like the French translation here better than the English. It says, to that point which we have come, let us walk together. Let us walk together. So there are some areas about where we're not in agreement, but I can still see the perspective of that brother, that sister, that husband, that wife. And so what I want to do is give credence to that and admit that that can be true. As from where they're looking. But the important thing is that to the point where we have come together, he says, let us walk together. Because, and that's why Paul says in Ephesians chapter 3 to keep the unit, or chapter 4, or chapter 5, keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace, bond of love. And so that's got to be your goal in visitation too, is to be an umpire, but to be a peacemaker and to help to interpret marriage counseling. It's being an interpreter. All you're doing is you're listening to what the one says and you're interpreting it to the other person. You're listening to what they're saying, you're interpreting what they're saying to the other person because they can't hear each other. And so you're there as an interpreter for those to help make sense and to help them be able to hear what the other person's saying. And so a creative alternative. And that's an important function. I'm going to skip over this other one because just with a little bit of mention, what does it mean, untangling the knots in someone's life? Factors that hinder, factors that help. It's just this is developed by Robert Karkoff. This was used in Dallas Theological Seminary as an approach to problem solving. And sometimes as you listen to people's stories, you just say, where in the world do you start? They've got so much going on, especially with unsaved people or new Christians. You can hear a story that says, talk sounds like this. There's financial pressures and disagreement. They got credit card debt, and yet they're still spending. One's still spending. The other's trying to keep the other from spending. They can have a sedentary lifestyle, lack of energy, poor eating habits. They can be growing conflict and hostility in their marriage. There's punitive attitudes that they have toward another, degrading speech, hurtful speech, depressogenic circle of friends and relatives, where they're in a situation that's being not only nourished by their friends and their relatives, but you know, where it says in 1 Peter 1:18, we've not been redeemed by perishable things as silver and gold, but by the precious blood of Christ. But redeemed from what? From the vain manner of living that they inherited from their fathers, it says. And so people come into the church or get into marriage with a whole lot of baggage behind them, the vain manner of living that they inherited from their fathers. And so you are confronted by this job insecurity, either underemployed or overemployed, disagreement over the children, their poor performance at school, their disrespect at home, their bad friends. No joy in their salvation, but doubt about God's love. So very little commitment, because very little real knowledge and participation in the church. Well, where do you start with those sorts of problems? Well, this is just a little idea of, and it's sort of self-explanatory, that you work on the easiest things. Many times people try to tackle the big things and get discouraged, and they go nowhere. And they just dig a deeper hole. And finally give up and separate, or I'll leave the church and I'll go there rather than trying to resolve where God has put me. And so what we do is we identify what are the hindrances. There they are, big ones, little ones, but we don't start with the biggest issues. We start with the littlest issues, because we have the greatest possibility of success in dealing with the little things than we do with the big things. The things that a person does have control over and can make choices and can put some effort. That's where we want to start. We want to encourage them and help them to be able to make progress, to change the line. And what we see here in the latter portion is if we resolve or improve a situation in a very small area, we've changed the perspective on the whole area, because now they've had a taste of success, a taste of progress in their life. And so we will maintain those other things for which we're responsible, but we'll concentrate our efforts on the little things we can do. And when we've made progress in those areas, then we'll go to the next thing on the list, not the biggest, and little by little we'll start making some progress on the overall picture in their life. And that gives hope, it gives confidence, and it gives the courage to continue on, and gradual, little by little, with the support, the line is moved to where they start seeing God doing things for them in their lives as they obey Him. Next page has to do with problem resolution and questions of decisions. This is something, again, that it was developed to help people give. Let me see. Our time should be just about up.
You've got about
10
minutes.
Wow. This perhaps is of lesser importance. Let's get on to something. Let's get on to dealing with offenses. That was the one that we already turned to at the beginning. But I said we'll leave that for a little later. Let's go back to that. We can find it. Okay, it's toward the back of the book, and you'll see a page where you see a car salesman. You'll see a fellow with his child looking at that car as a real prize, and you see the salesman there knowing that it's a pile of junk. This one came out of our experience of buying a car. And this is an interesting one, and it's a good one to share with folks too, because you turn the page where it says offenses, and people get so easily offended. You know, when we're offended, we don't tell anybody. We don't tell the person that offended us. We either tell everybody else, or we pack our bags and we move somewhere else. We head home, you know, and everybody wonders where they go and why they leave. Well, there's an offense. There's a hurt spirit there. David talks about this. Asaph talks about this. David in Psalm 37, Asaph in Psalm 73. And so this is a true-to-life story where when my wife and I moved from Three Rivers down to Montreal, we decided we had a truck up in Three Rivers, and we had to move down to Montreal, and so we decided to buy a car. So I went to a sales lot, and there was a little Toyota station wagon. Can't get anything better than that. But really, it was there were so many hidden defects in the thing that I didn't know about. And when I became aware of that, I went back to the sales lot to turn the car back in and reclaim my, I called the Automobile Protection Association. They said, take it back, tell them what's wrong with it, and then say, I want my vehicle back. Well, I bought the car on a Thursday. I went back to the sales lot on Saturday, and it wasn't there. It had moved. They were no longer there. And I had lost my good truck, and in the place I had this junk Toyota station wagon that was all rusted out and needed a lot of repairs. Well, brooding over the injustice of their success and their ease of life, bitterness and the shaking off of restraint of conscience, and self-pity and doubting of God's wisdom and goodness. My wife tried to console me, but I couldn't sleep. All I could think of was how to get even. You know, I just imagined in my mind, you know, taking my trusty Swiss knife and lashing all his tires in his car lot, or taking all those half-empty cans of paint in the basement and going there about 3 in the morning and just dousing all of his cars with a beautiful thought, you know. And you say, yeah, I can see the paper, local pastor jailed for vandalism, you know. But that was the thought. That was the reaction to the offense. And I was beyond consolation. My wife couldn't help me. Wrong emotional focus, contempt. And of course, this is nothing new. This little page comes right out of Bill Gothard's seminars, you know. But that's the experience. That's the experience when we get offended. And when we get hurt, we want to get even. Remember, don't get bitter, get even. And David talked about the same thing. Brooding, fretting, envy, self-pity, anger. And again, those components are there for depression. And so bitterness, it'll either turn to evil doing or it'll be internalized and will become depression. So before looking at what we can do to keep from fretting and brooding over the offense, let's look at what God wants to accomplish through it. Such painful experiences. How to keep from fretting and brooding. Self-explanatory, recognize the end of the wicked, that God's going to deal with them. They're storing up for themselves wrath. Recognize that the condition of the righteous is in every way better and more desirable than that of the wicked. Learn to focus our attention on God rather than on the wicked. Turn the next page, depart from evil, do good. Again, Psalm 37:27. The next page, if you find yourself brooding or fretting, see what I should say here is the whole idea of an emotional fixation. You know, because when I'm locked in anger or frustration over somebody who has offended me, I have an emotional fixation, emotional focus on that person, and that fills me. That consumes me. And so when I find myself brooding or fretting over that, like it says here, set a time limit of 2 minutes to think about it. So yeah, that's true, that I didn't like that one bit, and he did this and she did that and that sort of thing. And so I want to put myself on a time limit, 2 minutes to do that, and then I conclude the 2 minutes by prayer, leaving the care in God's hands, casting all his care upon me, for he cares for me. And so I want God to deal with that person, because he can really deal with them much better than I can. God knows how to twist an arm. I'm not strong enough. And he knows how to deal with sinners. Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. I will repay. And what kind of a testimony would I have if I had carried out the intents of my own heart? And I'd have been in jail today, probably. And then get up and turn to present responsibilities and pour your energies into them. Go out and cut the lawn, chop the wood, whatever it is. Go for a 5-mile run. Put 90 pounds on your back like the Marines. Turn the next page. How to develop a right emotional focus. And that is confessing. Fully forgiven the one resented. Oh, that's hard. I prefer the imprecatory prayers where you said, God, get in there and crush them or something like that. Break their arms. But, you know, concentrate. Concentration, rather, strengthens our emotional focus toward God, but continual review of his actions and attitudes. But again, you got to give people a hearing. You know, just like with the pressure cooker, there's a lot of pressure there, a lot of frustration, a lot of anger. You have to be the one that's going to facilitate the dissipation of that frustration and anger. And once they've gotten it out, you know, they can breathe easy. But you want to be the one, God's man, God's woman, to be able to give them your time and your compassion and listening to their frustration, listening to their anger, rather than saying you shouldn't feel that way. They got every right to feel that way. But again, once they've gotten that out, then they don't have to carry it anymore. And then it's going to produce conformity, concentrating on Christ and his word, allowing his spirit to produce basic changes in our attitudes. Let's just close for there. We'll take another break, and when we come back, remember there's some tapes up here.